All right. Hello, everybody. I'm so glad you can be here with us this morning. My name's Louise Yang. I'm part of the Adult Ed Committee, and I'm delighted to introduce Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon today. She will be presenting the last of three talks in our series on peace building in the Holy Land. Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon is going to talk to us about biblical foundations for Christian peace building and advocacy. She's the Executive Director of Churches for Middle East Peace and an ordained pastor in the Evangelical Covenant Church. She holds an MDiv from North Park Theological Seminary, an MBA from North Park University School of Business and Nonprofit Management, and an MA in Bioethics from Trinity International University. She received a PhD from the University of California and a second PhD in Ministry and Spiritual Formation from Northern Theological Seminary. She's the author of several books, including the award-winning Social Justice Handbook, Small Steps for a Better World. All right, I'll now open us in a word of prayer before I play a five-minute video to kick off the presentation. Gracious God, thank you for this beautiful morning. Thank you for bringing Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon here safely to be with our congregation. And thank you to Marshall for providing a leg of our transportation this morning. We ask that you be with us today, that you open our ears and our hearts to what Reverend Dr. May has to present, and please bless our time together. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.
Churches for Middle East Peace is a group of more than 30 church denominations and organizations around the United States committed to pursuing security, justice, and equality in Palestine, Israel, and the broader Middle East.
We work in close coalition with a number of organizations, faith-based, interfaith, or secular, all of whom are committed to justice and peace in the Middle East.
They've come together from different perspectives, conservative and liberal, to agree upon multiple policy positions. At CMEP, our priority is to educate, elevate, and advocate. Churches for Middle East Peace is a leading Christian advocacy organization here in Washington, D.C. and around the United States. We meet regularly with the White House, senators, congressional representatives, the State Department, and even heads of state. We've had the opportunity to speak and to educate at the United Nations and in other global forums.
We have three advocacy priorities: holistic peacebuilding, humanitarian and economic assistance, and human rights.
We also host advocacy summits in Washington, D.C. every year, and these are a great opportunity for Americans to come to the Capitol and speak with their congresspeople about issues that are important to them.
We want to educate American Christians about what's happening in the Middle East. We travel with Israelis and Palestinians, and we bring them to the U.S. to talk about their experiences and their realities.
Israelis are afraid, and they say about the Gaza Strip, "We left and we got rockets."
As Palestinians, every aspect of our life is controlled by Israeli military orders and regulations.
We offer the opportunity to have people go to Israel-Palestine on one of our multi-narrative trips. Once you see injustice visited upon children, once you see the wall and go through a checkpoint, it really changes your perspective.
Another priority is to elevate local voices from the Middle East.
We've brought Israeli and Palestinian leaders to speak directly to members of Congress and their staff on the struggles that they face.
Being able to explore, learn, understand, and participate in making peace through having these conversations.
We have the opportunity to meet face-to-face with communities under threat of demolition or displacement. We spend time in Gaza and get to meet with mothers whose children are suffering from malnutrition, to meet with children in Ofer Prison.
Children were beaten, they were injured. It's the only reality they know.
These are just some of the realities that we witness firsthand, and our responsibility is to come home and to tell our elected officials about the things that we've seen. Part of our work at CMAP is to support the sustainability of the Christian community in these places, to provide ways for them to be able to stay in their homes, and for the place where our faith tradition began to be able to thrive.
In Palestine, in the land of conflicts, we are people, Christian people. There are those who want to erase your civilization, your presence. We are suffering. What we ask from the Christian American to support us, to stand with us, to give hope for us.
Christians in the Holy Land tell us on a regular basis that our advocacy work here in the U.S. makes a huge difference and gives them hope.
The church is called to be peacemakers. The work that Churches for Middle East Peace is doing in really promoting a deep sense of peace and equality and justice in this land, and playing a major role in helping the church in the U.S. begin to understand what is really happening in this land.
We're all survivors of trauma, and the more we hear each other suffering, the more we might be able to move forward.
One of the things that we hear regularly from our friends and brothers and sisters in the Holy Land is about how difficult their current realities are, and yet they do not give up hope. And so for us here in the United States, we need to be reminded that despair is a luxury of the privileged. We can support their work by encouraging them, praying for them, advocating on their behalf here in the United States.
It's possible. It's possible for us to overcome. It's possible for us to reconcile with each other.
It's when people join forces to save lives, then maybe our leaders will hear.
Engaging in the work of human rights and advocating for justice is a discipleship journey for those of us who choose to follow Jesus.
What really drives our work, what inspires us, is the belief that peace is possible, justice can prevail.
Thank you. I asked if we thought it would be beneficial to get a glimpse of our work. How many of you have been to the region? Can you hear me okay? Many of you. I hope you can't, I don't know that there's anything I asked, but I don't know what to do about it. I'll try to speak very loudly. Is that better? Okay, good. Thank you. I wanted you to see some of the pictures. You know, this is the third session of 3 weeks. How many of you came to one or both of the other sessions? Almost all of you. So the first week was about the history of the conflict. Truth be told, my PhD is in the history of the conflict, so I would have preferred to have taught that session, but I hear Kyle did a great job. Second session, last week you heard from some voices from the land. Did you have the opportunity to see pictures and to see some of the realities that we were talking about a little bit? I wanted to show this video so that you could see the separation barrier. Are you familiar with what that is? Okay, good. That was a test to make sure those who went before me talked about it. In cities, it is twice as tall and three times as long as the Berlin Wall. It's considered illegal by international law because more than 80% of it is built on land designated to be the future Palestinian state or state of Palestine. But the separation barrier for Israelis is called the security fence. Does anyone know what the Palestinians call it? The apartheid wall. And I wanted you to see the video so you could see some of the pictures of children. I don't know if you had the opportunity. 3 weeks is a very short period of time, but to hear some of the stories, one of the major human rights issues that Churches for Middle East Peace works on is that of child detentions, which is Palestinian children who've been arrested, detained by the Israeli military. The majority of children are arrested in the middle of the night, taken out of their bed, having been accused of throwing stones. And the conviction ratio, when they go to court, they go to a military court because Palestinians in the West Bank do not have any civil rights. And the conviction ratio of these children is 99.9%.
And I wanted you to be able to see some of that before we talk about what we're going to focus on today, which is what is the role of the American church and what can we do about it? And I hope you feel compelled that there is a role we can play, and that I hope you're asking the question, what can we do about it? When you travel to the village of Nebi Saleh, which is a Palestinian village outside of Ramallah, it's a village that's involved in Palestinian resistance. I know you talked about the occupation. I want to pause, and I was going to do a little Q&A and say, who can tell me what the occupation is? But I don't know if you've all had your coffee yet this morning. Since you already did the history, I'm going to assume you know these words I'm talking about. But the occupation began in 1967, and that is when the control of East Jerusalem and the West Bank and Gaza came under Israeli control. So Palestinians living in the West Bank are living in a part of the occupied Palestinian territories. And so Nebi Saleh, the village I'm telling you about, is in the OPT, or, thank you, occupied Palestinian territories. Good. And in Nebi Saleh, when you arrive in the village, one of the things that you see, you turn and the family that lives there is the Tamimi family, and one of the houses on the right is Manal and Bilal Tamimi. I don't know how many of you heard the story of Ahmad Tamimi. It was called the slap heard around the world a few years ago because her cousin had been killed by soldiers in the village. And she has blonde hair and blue eyes, and she confronted a soldier and slapped him. And it was one of the few times when the situation in the West Bank, you know, garners international attention. So when you drive up to her family home, you'll see tear gas canisters hanging, and they look like Christmas lights. And guess what the tear gas canisters say on them? This relates to our culpability. Made in the USA. So I'm starting with the presumption that you think the U.S. has a role to play, you believe the church has a role to play, and I want to focus the next 15 minutes or so on some, I hope, encouraging words about what we might be able to do about it. This last week, I just came from Williamsburg. I was speaking at William and Mary and talking with some church partners, and I hadn't watched this video in a while, but we played the video, and when it got to the part where I said, despair is the luxury of the privileged, I was kind of overcome in my spirit because right now on the ground, things are horrific. Things are terrible. In Israel proper, many people would say Israel is almost on a civil war. I don't know if you saw, just in the last few days, some former members of the Israeli military stole a tank to protest Netanyahu and some of the things happening. In Israel proper, there's a similar government system to the U.S., a judiciary, you know, a parliament called the Knesset, and there are laws trying to diminish the power of the judiciary, which would make Israel less of a democracy than it currently is. And so Israel itself, in terms of its civil society and its governance, is a disaster. And that's not even talking about the 2.5 million Palestinians living in the West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem and the 2+ million Palestinians living in Gaza. I'm covering like 6 weeks of content in about 4.5 minutes. How's everybody doing? And we will have some time for question and answer. So is it fair that we feel like that we're ready to have the conversation of what can we do about it? Have you talked enough about the issues? Or do you need me to talk more about, do I need to convince you more before we start talking about advocacy? Go for it. Thank you. If you hadn't said anything, I would have been in trouble. Okay, so I wanted to spend a few minutes today talking about advocacy. I think the title of the talk is something about biblical advocacy, and since it said that, I'm going to give you at least one Bible verse. The Gospel of Matthew, in chapter 25, and you'd have to look up the specific verses, I think it starts around verse 14, there's the story of the sheep and the goats, and they're is this familiar to you? And it's the passage that says, it's Jesus speaking, and the main point of that passage is, whatever you do unto the least of these, you do unto me. And I think that passage is one that can guide the conversation we're having this morning. Let's ask the question, who are the least of these in the circumstance? And I guarantee, depending on the day and the time and the moment, sometimes that changes. Individually, there is trauma in Jewish communities and trauma in Arab communities. Corporately, when we talk about systemic power, we have to acknowledge that there's power differentials between the state of Israel and the people of Palestine who've been living under occupation since what year? Thank you, 67. I am glad to see you. Thank you. So what does it mean for us to advocate? We talk about CNEP advocating for peace and justice, and we'll talk some about our policy positions and the specifics of what that means. I know sometimes they say the devil is in the details, but what is advocacy? What's it mean to be an advocate? Yes, speaking, that's right. I like the language of on behalf of or alongside, because the issue is not that people are voiceless, it's often just that their voices are not heard. So you might have noticed in the video we said educate and elevate. We want to elevate voices that are often marginalized and often that aren't heard. What else does advocacy mean? Action. Like what? It could be policy action, yep. It could be something. And what does, if you take action related to policy, what are you trying to change? Yep, laws or practices, that's right. What else does it mean to be an advocate? Yes, absolutely. It can be a role of conciliation, you know, or trying to bring reconciliation. One of the challenges in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is often Palestinians are come to the table to reconcile, and you would hear from many Palestinians, no reconciliation without justice, that it's hard to come to the table unless you acknowledge wrongs that have been done, but a role of being an advocate can be bringing parties to the table. Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. In one of the books that was mentioned today that I wrote called Social Justice Handbook, I talk about a 9-step process of moving from apathy to advocacy, that to become an advocate, first we have to allow our hearts to be broken. I used to work for an organization called World Vision, and one of the founders of World Vision used to say, "Break my heart for the things that break the heart of God." And I promise you, if you are paying attention to what's happening in the Holy Land, it's something that should break our hearts. And so if we allow our hearts to be broken, we're not apathetic, the next step in the process is learning and being educated. And you heard about all my degrees. My husband used to tease, I had so many master's degrees. And you know that expression, jack of all trades and master of none? He would say master of all trades and doctorate of none. And then I got a couple doctorates, and, you know, that tells you a little bit about our relationship. One of the challenges with education is we can get stuck here. You know, I have my PhD, and I'm very educated on this issue, and there's still a ton I don't know. And sometimes we get information wrong, and that's okay. That's okay. What else in terms of what advocacy means or types of advocacy? Doesn't have to be related to the Middle East. Understanding global politics, yes. Understanding global politics. One of the exercises we often encourage our groups to do is, I'll tell you a story about a CEO, a very well-known CEO. I won't tell you who he is. He led a grocery store chain and lived out in Northern California. And he said, "I'm very informed about issues of the world." I said, "Oh, that's great. What newspapers do you read?" And he said, "I read the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post." That was supposed to be a joke. And I said, "Well, oh, do you read any other papers?" And he said, "No, You know, I don't have time for that. And so understanding global politics, one of the things we encourage people to do is read an Israeli newspaper. Haaretz, which means the land, is a Jewish newspaper, and it has a lot of information about what's happening on the ground. But don't just read Haaretz, read the Jerusalem Post, which has very different perspectives, and will tell you a different story. But don't just read Jewish-Israeli newspapers, read Al Jazeera. And guess what? Al Jazeera is actually pretty conservative when it comes to Arab politics. So if you really want to know what's going on, read Al-Quds or read one of the, you know, Arab nationalist newspapers, for example. So that's a great point. Anything else before we... I'm sorry? Economics, yes, absolutely. Having access... One of the ways we define biblical justice and social justice, if you want another Bible verse, how many of you would say Leviticus is your favorite book? Not mine either, true confessions. Ironically, it is also chapter 25 in Leviticus. Does anybody know what that's about? It's similar to the Golden Rule. It's the year of Jubilee, and it's a vision of the laws of God where the poor will be fed, but not only that, people who owe debt, their debts will be forgiven, people who are in prison. So when we see Jesus' very first sermon in Luke chapter 4, you know, he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to preach good news to the poor, to proclaim freedom for the captives, recovery of sight for the blind." That passage is referring to the year of Jubilee that's written about in Leviticus 25, which is all about economic justice. And so one might define biblical justice as all people having access to the blessings of God. Okay, this is good. I'm afraid that I did not ask for an eraser, but I... Okay. I'll use a tissue while we're... I want us to spend the next just few minutes talking about specific types of advocacy. And you started to, if I could keep this board that I'm just erasing, you actually already mentioned several of them. And there's more than this number, but I think this is a good starting point for answering the question of what can we do? Can you see that blue? Okay. So I'm going to list them all up here, and then I'll talk about each of them a little bit. And someone just mentioned economic, and I thought, oh, you're way ahead of the game. So five types of advocacy. I write about this extensively in my most recent book called Beyond Hashtag Activism. And one of the things I hope you leave feeling is that even if you're not going to go to Washington, D.C., or even if political advocacy is not something that stirs your spirit, there's still something that you can do. And so that's why I wanted us to talk through these five things. What do you think social advocacy means? What? Relationship building? Sure. I know this church has had a strong historic relationship with a neighboring synagogue, for example. That's a great start. What else? Yes, sharing the word. Yes, absolutely. Elevating voices. Cultural similarity, being able to identify where there's commonalities. Yes. One of the things we find, I speak in churches around the country. I've also spoken in mosques, and I was mentioning that I've spoken in some very conservative synagogues. And what I find is when you talk to American Jews or people in the United States from the Middle East, when you tell the stories of mothers, they're a lot more willing to listen to what current reality is like. Whereas when you're talking about the politics, it feels very different. But when you talk about, you know, the vast majority of Israeli mothers, Jewish or Arab, and the vast majority of Palestinian mothers just want to have a freedom where their sons and daughters are not serving in the military, or for Palestinians where their sons and daughters can go to school, you know, and not be harassed, where they can have freedom and liberty and equality. The main thing I'm talking about in terms of social advocacy, all of the things that you mentioned so far, it's about placing yourself and being vulnerable so that when there's situations in society that maybe are ignoring other parts of the story, you use your voice. So how many times are you sitting at a family dinner table over Thanksgiving and someone makes a comment and it kind of punches you in the gut? Maybe it was racially insensitive. Maybe it was neglecting to acknowledge someone's sexual identity in a way that's honoring to them. Maybe, and I'm not saying this to be presumptuous of what your thoughts are about these different issues, but it's about not letting conversations about this pass you by, but being present in them. It's about intervening in social situations to be a voice where truth and justice can be expressed. And this, of course, is relevant on any justice issue we're working on, but it's particularly relevant to Israel-Palestine. Spiritual advocacy, what's that all about? Prayer. Primarily, if you do nothing else for us, and this church is a church partner, please pray for us. We want to quit every day. My recruitment tool is come join us, we never win. It's true, right? And then donors always say, well, show me what you've done. And things today look a lot worse than they did decades ago. And so that whole idea of despair is the luxury of the privileged. Spiritual support so that we're reminded, if people on the ground suffering injustice don't give up, who are we to give up? So spiritual advocacy. Political advocacy, I know we talked about a little bit when we were brainstorming. We have a role to play with our elected officials, and one of the realities is U.S., I'll talk about federal policies, U.S. foreign policy towards Israel-Palestine is horrific. It's one of the only parts in the world where what's happening in Congress and what's happening in the White House, we're not having honest conversations. When you talk in the State Department, regardless of the administration, if it's Republican or Democrat, the State Department knows what's happening on the ground. You might remember during the Obama administration, there was a lot of conversation about whether or not there'd be a peace agreement. They called it the Kerry Initiative. And rumor has it that President Obama said to Secretary Kerry, go ahead and work on this. If you're successful, it was my idea. And if you're not, it's yours. Well, there was not a Kerry peace plan. It failed. But the State Department at that time had these maps that showed where Jewish settlements are, you know, in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza. But they didn't want to go public because just by printing these maps from the U.S. State Department shows that there's these settlements that exist that make the two-state solution virtually impossible. And it was too political to print these maps. And so my point of all of this is we have a role to play, one, in encouraging the State Department. They're the experts on this issue. Often we would meet with the White House and the State Department, and the White House didn't know what the State Department was doing, and the State Department didn't know what the White House was doing. Heaven help us. But then on Capitol Hill, we have an expression that's called progressive on everything but Palestine. Have you heard that? It does not matter if you are Republican or Democrat, you can't have any alternative views as it relates to Israel and get elected on Capitol Hill. Now, I'm being a little bit, my husband would say hyperbolic, but you know, we took a senator to Israel-Palestine, an African-American. He was not a senator when we took him about 2 years before he was elected. And his heart was utterly broken by what he saw. He came back. He leads a very well-known national church. I won't tell you in what city, because then you'll know who he is. And he gave this sermon when he came back about the things that he saw and about the African-American struggle for justice and how it equates to the Palestinian struggle for human rights and for justice. And then he ran for Senate. And what do you think happened? Nothing. He can't, you know, and then, and I don't blame him, right? We have to be, one of the things we could talk about is the difference between pragmatic and prophetic advocacy. And he was so prophetic, but to be elected, he had to be pragmatic. But my point is, we're not even having honest conversations. I personally believe if you are truly pro-Israel, from a political standpoint, the most pro-Israel viewpoint you can have is that the occupation of the Palestinian people has to be brought to an end. That's the most pro-Israel you can be. And in fact, years ago, I don't know if any of you saw the film The Gatekeepers. It won the Academy Award for the best documentary. And it was very high-ranking retired generals and leaders of the Shin Bet and the Israeli security establishment. And they made the argument, if you truly care about Israel, you have to end the occupation. They said the occupation is the greatest threat to Israel's security that exists. So we have a lot of work to do in the political space. And I hope, and we can talk about this in the question and answer, I hope that you'll consider joining us. Lena, I think, just left. She's one of our regional coordinators. But CMEP has an advocacy summit on April 20th. Did Kyle talk about this at all? Okay, in Washington, D.C., one of the things we do is we invite our church partners and people that are our constituents to come to Washington, and we do 2 days where a day is just learning about what's happening on the ground, and a day is spent meeting with your elected members to tell about the things that you've learned. And so I'd love for you to consider joining us. You can find that. I know my handwriting's abysmal, I'm sorry, but it's on our website where I can certainly give this to your pastors and leaders. To make sure you have that information. But we invite people to engage in action alerts, you know, even without coming to D.C., but April 20th and 21st we'll be in D.C. together doing political advocacy. Legal advocacy is kind of the most straightforward. I often use the example, you know, of children in child detentions. We talked about that already. And so I had the privilege of taking one of the He used to be the general counsel of International Prison Fellowship. Do you know that group? Do you remember Chuck Colson? That was his group. That was his prison. I might have gotten the name wrong. Something Prison Fellowship. It was Chuck Colson's group. And the head counsel for them came from a very, very pro-Israel perspective. And I hope you hear me saying, we want to be pro-Israel, pro-Palestine, pro-peace, and pro-justice. But he came on the ground with me, and I took him to watch some court cases of some of these Palestinian children. And he was astounded that, you know, the entire court case is conducted in Hebrew. And so children and their parents don't know what's happening. Often they sign confessions that are written in Hebrew, and, you know, children only read and understand Arabic. And so we partner with a lot of legal organizations, Defense for Children International, that was featured in the video, and others who try to provide legal advocacy. In the United States, this is a huge issue. CMEP, I just want you to know, Churches for Middle East Peace, is neutral on the issue of this word. Have you heard of this? BDS? Anybody know what it stands for? Boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And a lot of our denominations support BDS. Some of our denominations that are more tied to traditional churches in the Holy Land don't support it because they don't think it's the most strategic. But boycott, divestment, and sanctions, there is a movement in the United States, and this relates to legal advocacy, that is trying to make it illegal for Americans to boycott Israel. To the point to where federal legislation has been proposed that if you decided personally to boycott Israel, you could go to prison for up to 10 years and have to pay, you know, exorbitant fees. This is happening on the state level and also on the federal level. And so CMEP's position is, regardless of what, if you think BDS is effective or not, as Americans and as a democracy, we should have the right, because of free speech, to be able to engage in boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And so we work with the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, doing political advocacy. But there's tons of lawsuits right now related to the right to boycott. And a moderate stance towards boycotting is that it's possible to boycott settlement-only products that are made in the OPT. So in Europe, for example, settlement products are actually labeled. Whereas in the United States, most of us don't know what's made in an Israeli settlement. And then the last type of advocacy is economic advocacy, which can be supporting programs on the ground. I think that one's pretty straightforward. So I went 7 minutes longer than I was supposed to before our question and answer time. I hope we'll have just 2 minutes before we end where I could just invite you on a few next steps. But I'm out of breath and ready for some discussion if you have thoughts or questions. Yes.
View about, oh, thank you. Gave an Netanyahu gave her an interview recently about whether or not he supports a two-state solution now that he's premier, and he pretty much said he did not, that he advocated for economic rights, not political rights, if I am interpreting that correctly. What's your reaction to that? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that if we really listen to what's coming out of the mouths of Israeli politicians, we have a lot to be concerned about, because they're not hiding the fact that they don't want to have a democracy. They want to have a democracy, but only for Jewish people. And that's what he was just saying, right? He was saying, I want, say it again, not
economic rights.
Economic rights. Yes, but not political rights. What I think about that is this. Have any of you ever seen this triangle? Jewishness. Land, Jewish, democracy. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which in large part is a contemporary geopolitical conflict, it is based on these three issues. Here's a triangle. On one side you have Jewishness, on one side you have land, on one side you have democracy. Any solution to the conflict can only have two of the three. You'll never be able to have all three. If you have a Jewish democracy, what won't you have? You can't have the whole land. If you have the land that's a democracy, you have more than 5 million, Arabs in the OPT, not in addition to the 20% of Israel proper that are Palestinian citizens of Israel. If you have a land and a democracy where there's equal rights, economic rights, political rights, social rights, it's not going to be Jewish, right? Or you can have Jewish land, and then what's going to happen? It's not going to be a democracy. So you're actually seeing laws in Israel right now that are trying to deprive Palestinian citizens of Israel of their rights. I'm going very fast. Did you hear what I said about what percentage of Israel proper is Palestinian? 20% have citizenship, but they don't have equal rights as citizens of Israel. So that would be my response to that question. Yes, please.
I'm just wondering how you deal with one of the things that happens when people speak up about what's going on and use such terms as apartheid, and they're immediately accused of being anti-Semitic, which I think has been a very effective silencing tactic, along with sort of the economics of our elections in this country. And I'm just wondering what thoughts you have about how people should deal with this.
Yes, that's a great question. I think one of the things that I try to do personally, but I also talk to our staff about, I want us to have integrity. So I mentioned speaking in conservative synagogues and speaking in different places, and we were talking today about lexicon. A lot of times the way we speak in different spaces sounds differently, because a word like Zionism can mean something different depending on where you are, right? I think one of the most profound things we can do to address the conflation of anti-Semitism and criticism of the state of Israel, the most profound thing we can do is be ardent advocates against anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism absolutely exists. And it exists, the national movement in Palestine of BDS, I'll be very honest with you, there are aspects of it that are very, very anti-Semitic. Now, that doesn't mean BDS should be thrown out with the bathwater, but it means we should be honest about where we see it and seeking to eradicate it. I think also we have a lot of allies in the Jewish community who would agree that it's very, very dangerous to conflate anti-Semitism and criticism of the state of Israel. And a lot of conservative advocates that would say that's against democracy, right? And so I think being in relationship with people who can speak for us is very helpful. And then my last comment in that regard is just that we're not always going to get it right. And being open and honest about when we get it wrong, I think is really important. So I spoke, for example, you might be familiar at Christ at the Checkpoint, and I've spoken at the gathering in Bethlehem. It's a Christian conference that addresses Palestinian human rights, and they did an event in Oklahoma. And one of the speakers who went before me made some comments that resonated very strongly with historic anti-Semitism, comments about kind of Jews taking over the world, or And I wrote an article about some of these, but there's a lot of documentation about what does it mean to be anti-Semitic? What's it look like? What are some of the tropes of anti-Semitism? And I got a call the night before I spoke from an Orthodox rabbi who's very, very critical of my work. And he said, how can you even speak there with how anti-Semitic they are? And I said, you know, thank you. Thank you for raising this and bringing this to my attention. I think that the issues we're talking about at the conference still have to be discussed. But in my talk the next day, I addressed the issue and talked about the issue. And so I think acknowledging when our communities or when we as individuals don't get it right is an important step in that direction. Yes.
I know that it's... Thank you. It's not easy, especially to recognize the right of the common people. And I wonder, how do you also work with other churches outside the United States? For example, in Indonesia, as a Muslim country, has a, I understand that try to facilitate this as well. How the church from U.S. can work with church within, because this is a model how minority has a right in the majority. And the example might encourage the Israel to think about what kind of state provided the minority right.
Yes.
In the constitution level, not only in the economic level.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think the question is about how does this, what do we learn and how do we engage with the international community? Churches for Middle East Peace is U.S. focused. Our expertise is on the United States. We have our hands full with that. We can't handle the rest of the world. but I think we have a lot to learn about similar conflicts that have happened in the world. And I would point you to, we have a resource on the CMEP website, a book called A Land Full of God. Have any of you heard of this? Have we talked about this at all? And I promise I'm not just here promoting my books, because that sounds, I feel really ridiculous, and I make no money on it. Any money made goes towards our work. But I edited the book, and it's 30 chapters of divergent perspectives, but Archbishop Desmond Tutu gave us a chapter there. And guess what his chapter title was called? It's what the Arabs call the wall. The Palestinians call the separation barrier. Apartheid. And one of the things, this relates to what do we learn from the international community. If Desmond Tutu thinks what's happening in Palestine is apartheid, I think he knows a lot more about apartheid than I, right? And so I think one of the things we need to do is to learn from others. How do those who have experienced oppression in their own contexts, how are they seeing this situation, and how do they view it, and what language are they using? And I think that's an important part of the conversation. May I just pause very quickly, and then I'll go to you. What time do we stop?
We've got 6 minutes.
6 minutes. Okay, last two questions. Oh, I think, were you number two? Okay, right here and then right here.
Yeah. Sorry, I have two questions.
Oh, no.
I'll try to be as quick as possible. So the first one, you mentioned that you're mostly U.S. focused, but I'm curious what you think about how much closer European countries are to move the needle for action to actually begin, you know, in terms of the Israeli state realizing we can't keep doing this, it's a dead end. And then the second question is, based on the what happened when the Gaza settlers left and how traumatic that was,
yes,
and how much smaller that is than what's happening in the West Bank, Do you really have hope for a two-state solution?
Yeah, great question. Great questions. Related to Europe, I don't think Europe is any closer. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would say Europe was closer. You know, the labeling of settlement products, honest conversations. But Europe has had the same political trajectory in many ways as the United States, with the rise of nationalism and what happened here with January 6th. And you're seeing a lot of that in Europe as well. I was going to say there's no hope for Europe, but don't quote me on that. The other thing is Israel doesn't listen to Europe. And so, you know, the Swedes, we partner. I have a great relationship. Ambassador Olofsdottir is the Swedish ambassador to the United States. The Swedes have fabulous policies on this issue. But with all due respect, and I'm from the Swedish covenant, that's what I'm ordained in as a denomination, Israel doesn't care. And so the U.S., because we invest more than $3 billion a year, you know, we will be much more influential. Now, strategically, we do have a partnership based in the UK and Europe, because often we, as an American-based organization, make more traction in Europe than we do with our own constituents, you know, either in Washington, D.C. or with our denominations. So I don't think I'm disclosing something that I shouldn't. I had to pause there for a minute. But the Catholic Church, for example, the U.S. Catholic Church, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has moved to increasing conservatism where they won't touch this issue. And they're on our board. They've been an ally. But we're a part of the Holy Land Coordination Committee that's based with Catholic bishops in London and Europe. And they're more progressive than we are in the way that we speak. And so we partner with them so that we'll have influence in the U.S., if that makes any sense. What was your second question?
State solution.
One state solution. Do we have any hope?
For the two states, yeah.
Or two states. You know, for years and years, Palestinians on the ground would be saying the two-state solution is dead. For many Jews, there, and regardless of if we think this is legitimate or not, for many Israeli Jews, they believe a one-state solution would mean their eradication. And so we can say that's legitimate or not, you know, politically, et cetera. What I like to say is that people of faith and Christians who choose to follow Jesus, the two-state solution may be dead, but we're people who believe in the resurrection. Now, I joke, right? It's funny. Evangelicals really like that joke. You guys didn't, I mean, you know. The thing about a solution is this is the most well-studied conflict of our day. There's dozens of possible solutions. There could be a federated state. There could be two states. You know, the UN partition plan in 47 was the precursor to the two-state solution, but it called on the major cities and holy sites being internationalized. And so it's not that there's not answers. It's that there's not political will. So last question. What happens to those Palestinian children who are convicted? Well, I think a couple of things happen. One, they are traumatized. You know, you have many of these are children, and I like to say youth. 18 and under is by legal definition a child, but I think culpability for a 15, 16, 17-year-old is different than culpability for a 7, 8, or 9-year-old. It used to be under the military law that children 16 to 18 were not considered children, so it's actually helpful to identify that. In addition to trauma, many of these mostly young men wet the bed. They often act out in aggressive ways towards their fellow siblings in their household. They often miss school, so the average length of time being held in detention for throwing stones used to be between 5 and 7 months, and so education is significantly interrupted. And I don't know statistics about this, but I don't know how Israel is not creating a generation that is angry toward them. I think it's a short-term viewpoint. You know, one of the things that happens when children are detained is that the entire family is arrested. I heard a noise and got distracted. They're not arrested. The entire family is woken up in the middle of the night and are documented. And so child detentions is used as an excuse for population control to document who is where in the West Bank. And it's just a horrific issue. And it's the only human rights legislation towards Palestine that's been proposed on Capitol Hill. by Betty McCollum to say U.S. funding should not support the detaining of Palestinian children. And if we can't agree on anything, you know, maybe that's something we can agree on. And yet, with that legislation, only a few dozen congresspeople have voted in favor. You know, it will not pass. So I want to leave, and I'll do this in 30 seconds. Next steps. Thank you so much for your church partnership. I would love to talk about, could we do more? And, you know, I'll be meeting with your pastors and leaders, but, you know, maybe we could do a workshop, because guess what? We just did that in, I don't know, 50 minutes, and there was a lot we didn't cover. You know, could we do a day together, a workshop or something like that, you know, in terms of education? Might you consider joining us for the Advocacy Summit? You're not far away. I got on an early train this morning, but it only took about 2.5 hours, I think, from Washington, D.C. So join us or consider joining us April 20th to 21st. Maybe it's time for the church to take another trip. I know you've taken trips to the region in the past, and we would invite you to consider doing that. And then, you know, the last thing would just be, how might you be called individually to engage? There's so many things that you can do as individuals and a community. So I'm grateful for our time together. Thank you for having us in your church 3 Sundays in a row. And thank you for your support of Churches for Middle East Peace.
Thank you, May. May's going to be leading us in worship, so stay for worship, everyone. And next week we begin our Lenten series on parables, and the first session will be led by Dale Allison from the seminary, so come back next week as well. Thank you, May. Thank you for your organization, too. Yeah.